Without firm solutions from the political class, it seems the upcoming period might hold still more pain for those who can ill afford it. Amina Taylor, London.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that more than $300 billion is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
It was a referendum that would change Britain's future forever. 52% of those who turned out to vote in 2016 chose to leave the EU, setting to motion years of negotiations and changes to laws and legislation. The man championing the cause, Nigel Farage.
We will be leaving this prison of nations at the end of January. And we won't become a third country, as I've been hearing this morning. No, we're going to become an independent, self-governing nation.
A nation that voted in Brexiteer-in-chief, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, to power, who promised an oven-ready post-Brexit deal with the EU and prosperity for Britons. 6 years on and five prime ministers later, the country is facing an economic downturn, expected to last until 2024, and a de facto general strike by public sector workers over pay and conditions.
Small and large businesses up and down the country have been feeling the impact of Brexit in different ways, from added paperwork on borders to shortages of labor. In October, a Confederation of British Industry report said that three-quarters of UK companies have been hit by labor shortages in the past year.
Since the new Brexit rules took effect at the start of 2021, EU nationals no longer have the freedom to work in the UK. Instead, a new points-based immigration system has been implemented to attract skilled workers. Marlies Hazelton has lived here for nearly 40 years.
I can't even get citizenship, and it feels a bit like an insult, because I'm part and parcel of this country, really. I'm part of the furniture, and I've lost that sense of home.
The UK's withdrawal from the EU has also impacted the country's trade. After the pandemic, trade in almost all G7 nations has been recovering. The one exception is the UK, thanks to the Northern Ireland Protocol.
You can compare Britain with what's going on in Europe, you see, because they've also suffered the Ukraine shock. They've suffered that. So we can look at the data and see how Britain is doing relative to the average of those EU countries that are most similar to us. And it's those statistics that show that the British economy is 4% smaller, investment about 10% smaller than it would otherwise be.
The predictions for next year's GDP growth show a similar story. According to the OECD predictions, the British economy is not likely to grow in 2023. It's estimated to perform worse than advanced economies like China, Canada, and Japan. Even developing nations such as Indonesia are ahead of the UK. And one country below Britain is Russia, which is currently under heavy economic sanctions. As Britain faces a winter of discontent on a par with the one in 1978, it's become increasingly more evident that it's Britain that risks becoming the lame duck of the G7 due to Brexit and Brexit alone. Sai Purza, London.
Fuel prices have slightly dropped in Yemen after the release of two Yemeni fuel ships that were detained by the Saudi-led coalition earlier this week in the Red Sea. The Yemeni army issued a stern warning to Saudi Arabia and the UAE that if the ships were not released soon, military action would follow. Yemeni bus and motorbike drivers in the capital Sana'a, who make a living from public transportation, welcomed the lowering of fuel prices. They say this is going to help them cope with the fuel price hike caused by the blockade.
As you can see, I am pumping 1 liter for only 500 Yemeni riyals, whereas before it used to cost us 1,500 to 2,000 for 1 liter.
The Saudi-led coalition who are seizing Yemeni fuel ships do not respond to peaceful dialogue. They only respond to us when we decide to use our military power, and if that's the case, so be it.
Yemeni political expert says the release of the fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition isn't enough, as Yemen will continue to struggle until Saudi Arabia and its allies completely lift the blockade and end their illegal involvement in Yemen.
Although the price of fuel has slightly dropped, we still need to look at the more pressing issue, and that is the fact that the Saudi-led coalition is still occupying Yemen. We need to reach an ultimate solution that can only come through taking decisive military actions against them. This is the only solution.
Despite falling oil prices, tensions are rising on all active battlefronts in Yemen for what could soon be a resumption of war if a political solution is not reached soon. This as Saudi Arabia and the UAE continue their militarization of strategic Yemeni islands in the Red and Arabian Sea.
The release of Yemeni fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition marks a big victory for the Yemeni government based in Sana'a and to the people living in the areas controlled by Ansar Allah. This also indicates that Saudi Arabia and the UAE simply cannot afford to have their oil industry targeted by Yemeni ballistic missiles, which is why they chose a safer option by releasing the fuel vessels. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
...2022 has been dominated by a cost-of-living crisis, and the figures are staggering. Inflation is running at a double-digit pace, the highest in 40 years, and far outpacing wage growth. While food prices have shot up almost 20%, and the cost of heating a typical home has jumped more than 150%. As temperatures plummet below zero and desperation rises, key sector worker unions have launched mass strike actions to pressure the government to force wage rises.
The people who are out here on strike today are the same people who not only worked through the pandemic, we worked for the people. We'd get their prescriptions, we'd get their milk and bread.
We just want a pay rise in line with the cost of living. At the moment, what we're getting is actually in terms of a pay cut. So it's not even in line with inflation. Everything's gone up. We're just like everybody else. We're all struggling.
This is not about pay. This is about our jobs.
The situation has become so dire in Britain that many families will have to choose whether to heat their homes or feed their families this Christmas.
It is very distressing. It's a situation which, in a way, unimaginable for a country which is supposed to be one of the richest countries in Europe and in the West. Why is it we have these extremes of poverty? Why are people, some people, forced to choose between heating and eating? I mean, there's something completely wrong about our system. We should be plugging and supporting and promoting equality and, you know, not oppressing the poor. You know, there's something which says a lot about our political system, which is flawed.
The government has pinned much of the blame on economic recovery from the COVID era. However, critics say its ruling Conservative Party incompetence and leadership instability that has also left the economy in a dire state. A lesser discussed reason for a European-wide crisis is the ongoing Ukraine war. Britain has remained a staunch supporter of continued fighting, even upping its shipments of arms and financial support.
I think the first is ensuring that we deliver more military aid and that that military aid evolves to meet the situation that we're now facing. And that means more air defence systems, it means artillery, it means armoured vehicles. For our part in the United Kingdom, we've pledged to match or exceed the £2.3 billion in aid that we provided this year, next year.
Low wages, higher fuel costs, inflation and major strike action have all marred 2022. Does the government have what it takes to resolve these many issues in 2023? Probably not. It's going to be a long road with most likely higher taxation, major cuts in public spending, and renewed pressure on an already struggling British working class. Robert Carter, London.
Caskets with the remains of unidentified martyrs draped in Iranian flags and carried in mass processions. For many Iranian families, the painful legacy of the eight-year Iran-Iraq war, referred to as the Sacred Defense, drags on after more than three decades as they hopefully wait for news of loved ones still missing.
The martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatimeh, Lady Fatimeh, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, became the perfect occasion to bid farewell to 400 unknown soldiers of the eight-year Iraqi imposed war.
In the capital, Tehran, the last farewell on Tuesday honored 200 soldiers whose remains were recently recovered from the former battlefields along the Iran-Iraq border. Funerals were held for another 200 soldiers in other cities and towns across Iran. None of the soldiers have been identified, and their remains are to be buried as unknown martyrs.
We should never forget the martyrs, their families, and the sacrifices they made for us to be here today. And the occasion of Hazrat Fatimeh's martyrdom anniversary is the best reminder of that.
Iran has been the scene of foreign-backed riots since mid-September, and many who attended the funeral procession saw it as an opportunity to send a message to the enemies of the Islamic Republic.
I personally came here because I think that at this very crucial point in time, it is important for me and my generation to show support for the Islamic Republic of Iran, to show that the way mainstream media is trying to portray Iran these days is fake news, and that my generation will always uphold the values of those who lost their lives for the independence of our country.
We will walk down the same path as our martyrs. Our presence here is a clear message to all of our enemies and the rioters in particular.
We have pledged allegiance to our leader Ayatollah Khamenei, and no matter what happens, we will always support the leader. Especially these days, it is even more important to be vocal about it.
Trucks piled high with the caskets made their way through the streets. Men and women in black followed them weeping for those who lost their lives in a bloody war which left more than a million casualties on both sides. But most importantly, they turned out once again to pledge allegiance to the Islamic Republic of Iran. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In 2002, during the Second Palestinian Intifada, the Zionist regime began constructing the separation wall, the total length of which is expected to be 712 kilometers upon completion. According to reports, 85% of the wall is being built inside occupied Palestinian territory, leading many to conclude that its construction is aimed at annexing more land. In this regard, we have provided world media views about this issue. Stay tuned for more. The website of the Electronic Intifada wrote, Sakina Al-Gharib, 74, remembers when she first moved into her white stone house. It was more than 40 years ago, soon after marrying her husband Sabri, who died in 2012. Nestled on a hilltop near their occupied West Bank village of Beit Ejiza, just north of Al-Quds, Sakina would wake up each morning and look out at the rolling hills of olive trees lighting up under the rising sun. We were the only family on this hilltop, Sakina told the Electronic Intifada, adding, it was very quiet and peaceful. We used to be able to see the Mediterranean Sea from here. It was the perfect place to raise our children. The family built this home in 1979 on 100,000 square meters of land, which has been in their possession since Ottoman times. Now, however, the fabricated regime of Israel has confiscated almost all their land, and their home is surrounded by an 8-meter-high iron fence. The hills of olive trees have been replaced by villas, 2 or 3 stories high, built for Israeli settling in the area in violation of international law. Sakina said, "We are in a constant state of fear and insecurity. We feel like at any moment, Israeli troops can come and arrest us or destroy our home. It's like we are living in a prison." There is just one entrance to the Gharib family's home, with a cement corridor giving way to a tall iron barrier separating the family from Israeli settlements surrounding them. Cameras are pointed at the entrance of the family's home, a gated structure of cement and fencing. More are mounted under Israeli neighbors' homes, facing the Gharib family's one-story house. The iron fencing around the Gharib family within the ever-growing Israeli settlement surrounding them is just one part of the labyrinth of fences, bypass roads. There is even a tunnel that severs access to their lands in this area. On the way to the family's home, driving through Beit Ejiza's village center, posters and large banners displaying image of 36-year-old Muhammad Awad are pasted on shop windows and draped across homes. Awad was a teacher and father of three who was shot and killed by the Zionist regime forces in September. The tributes to him are visible reminders of the Armenian settler violence that has shaped the lives of Palestinians in this village over several decades. According to Saadat Gharib, Sakina's 41-year-old son, the Zionist regime began the process of confiscating the family's land almost immediately after his parents built the home. In 1979, 12 years after the Zionist regime took control of the West Bank following the 1967 Six-Day War, makeshift containers have already been erected near the family's lands, where a few Israeli settlers established themselves. The settlers would at times approach Saadat's father, Sabri, with requests to buy parts of the land, offers he promptly refused. Saadat said they offered him a lot of money, but my father consistently told them that this land was not for sale. All the Israeli money in the world would not be enough to buy even a meter of this land. And then the drama soon began. In 1983, the Givon settlement was established and the Zionist regime cabinet attempt to confiscate 25,000 square meters of the Palestinian family's land. The case went to the Zionist regime's high court, but in 1993, this was postponed after the Oslo Accords were signed by the Palestinian Liberation Organization and the fabricated regime of Israel. The Oslo agreements established the administrative division of the West Bank into areas A, B and C as a transitional arrangement pending a final status agreement. Area C, which makes up more than 60% of the West Bank, was put under full Israeli regime control. Despite granting the PA control over administrative and internal security matters in parts of the West Bank, the Zionist regime maintains ultimate military control over the entire area. The Oslo agreements were meant to set the stage for peace talks brokered by the U.S. regime with the objective of negotiating a two-state solution. Instead, they left the Zionist regime in complete control of the Palestinian economy. The Zionist regime has since rapidly expanded its settlements throughout Area C of the West Bank. In 1993, the year the Oslo Accords were signed, the population of Israeli settlers in the West Bank, excluding occupied East Al-Quds, was 116,300. Now the number of Israeli settlers has exploded to more than 465,000, with a further 230,000 settlers in the occupied East Al-Quds. Through the Oslo negotiations, the Israeli regime was able to confiscate 168,000 square meters of Beit Ejzan's land, about 6.5% of the total village area, to make more room for the Givat Ziv and Givon settlements. According to Saadat, his late father Sabri traveled to Gaza three times to meet leaders, then chair of the PLO, to plead with the leader to protect his land from the Zionist regime confiscation during the Oslo negotiations. In the end, the 40,000 square meters where the family had managed a small farm growing wheat and barley was simply confiscated by the fabricated regime of Israel, bringing an end to the protracted court proceedings. Over the years, the Gharib family has been squeezed into a tiny piece of their land measuring just 400 square meters. The Zionist settler population of Givon has grown to 1,250. With Givat Ziv, the other settlement in the area, the total number of settlers is some 12,000. In 2002, during the Second Palestinian Intifada, the fabricated regime of Israel began constructing the separation wall, the total length of which is expected to be 712 kilometers upon completion. According to Israeli Rights group B'Tselem, 85% of the wall is being built inside occupied Palestinian territory, leading many to conclude that its construction has little to do with security and is instead aimed at annexing more land. According to Saadat, owing to protests and a battle in the Israeli courts, the village was able to freeze the wall's construction in Beit Ejza until 25, at which point the building work resumed. According to rights groups, the wall extends 2 kilometers onto Beit Ejza's lands and isolates 980,000 square meters of the eastern part of the village on the Israeli side of the barrier. When the Zionist regime's wall reached the Gharib family's home at the end of 2006, around 100 Israeli troops also arrived. After prolonged confrontations between the family and the troops, Sabri, who was then in his 70s, along with Saadat and his brother, who were both in their 20s, were arrested. Sabri had a stroke during the ordeal, his health taking a turn for the worse. The men were released after 6 months to find their home surrounded on three sides by a 1-meter-high cement wall and tall iron fencing, 8 meters high. The enclosure only has one narrow passage out to the village center and neighboring Palestinian communities. Saadat said, "I felt so much pain when I saw the enclosure." Straddled on his lap, he said, "I also felt anger because you cannot do anything about what is happening to you. We don't have a big army like them to protect us. We are powerless against these injustices happening to us by Israelis." In addition to being enclosed into a fenced enclave bordered by rows of Israeli settler homes, the 60,000 square meters of the rest of the family's 100,000 square meters piece of land also ended up on the Zionist side of the wall. For generations, the Gharib family had planted grapes and olive trees on this land. They can now only access it for a few days each year for grape harvesting and olive picking, and only with an Israeli regime army permit. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency wrote, the Zionist regime occupation forces on November 23rd raided the village of Beit Ejza, northwest of occupied Al-Quds, where they searched Palestinian homes and assaulted the dwellers following the blast that targeted a bus stop in nearby Ramot settlement. Eyewitnesses said forces raided and searched several homes in the village and attacked residents, including journalist Ahmad Hababe, who works for Palestine TV. The village was sealed off by Israeli regime army since early morning hours. The village, home to at least 2,000 people, is segregated from other neighboring Palestinian villages by the Zionist regime separation wall. Non-residents are not allowed to enter the village without obtaining a special entry permit.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld a controversial Title 42 border policy. But what is a Title 42 policy in the first place, and why is it important?
For starters, it uses public health as a justification for expelling asylum seekers. But is that justified under the norms of human rights, especially when it comes to asylum seekers and international law? And why have rights groups characterized it as arbitrary and illegal? In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll look at the controversy surrounding not only this Title 42 provision, but whether the issue of asylum seekers, which has been a problem for the U.S., has its roots in maybe U.S. foreign policy. Let's find those questions and a lot more from our guests. Let me introduce them. Barbara Petillo joins us. He's a political activist and attorney from Washington, D.C. Also joining us, David K. Johnson, investigative journalist and author, who joins us from Rochester, New York. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Barbara Petillo, I'll start first with you. And of course, given the name, maybe some are not aware what it is, I included. And you can explain to us what it is and why is it that it's been used by the current and previous U.S. administrations, which appears on the surface anyways, in order to expel either migrants or asylum seekers.
Well, the United States has had an issue with immigration dating back 40 years. The last time we had any major efforts to ameliorate the problem was Ronald Reagan back in 1986, when he granted what many call amnesty to all of the, or to a large number of migrants who are currently in the country at that time. Since then, America has kicked the can down the road on what's called comprehensive immigration reform. This will be reforming our border, instituting border security, creating a pathway to citizenship, dealing with our guest worker program, modernizing our H-1B visa program to bring high-skilled laborers over, in addition to dealing with DACA. Those are children who were brought to this country as infants who grew up here but do not have citizenship standards. Concurrent with this, during the beginning parts of the pandemic, the Trump administration, because they had not been able to pass comprehensive immigration reform in 2018, instituted this policy, Title 42, which allows the Department of Homeland Security and Immigration and Naturalization Services to deport migrants and asylum seekers without going through the normal process of claiming asylum, having a hearing under international law, under the pandemic emergency. Since then, almost all the pandemic emergency powers have been repealed, be that masking in public, vaccine mandates, separation, those sorts of things. But Title 42 remains in place. The Biden administration has sought to allow Title 42 to expire in order to return to the traditional method within the context of international law for asylum seekers. However, the Supreme Court has overruled him on that.
I was trying to keep up with all the fact that you were giving me. I think I gave up halfway through it. I do apologize for that. But before I go to David K. Johnson, what I want to find out from you, did what Trump do in terms of this Title 42 something that was legal in the way that he presented it and came up with this in terms of wanting to reach his goal of not letting people in the U.S., whether they're asylum seekers or migrants?
Well, presidents are normally granted special emergency powers during national emergencies. President Trump used the excuse of the coronavirus pandemic to institute Title 42 towards his broader gain, broader goal of reducing immigration from Central and South America. However, that was supposed to expire when the emergency was over. What the courts have done, because we have a 6-3 conservative majority on the court, they have overruled the president, they have overruled the Congress, and basically, according to Justice Gorsuch, made themselves the arbiter of U.S. immigration law, which is outside the counsel the court is supposed to do.
Okay, thank you for that. All right, W.K. Johnson, what do you think? Tell us maybe in a bit simpler terms as to what you think about this. But overall, what's the crisis and controversy about here?
Well, first of all, everything Robert Petillo told you is right on the money. So let me give a little broader context to this. There is, in the history of the world, no wealthy country bordering or near a poor country or countries that has kept people from coming in. Human beings who get up and leave tend also to be the people who have the most gumption and accomplish something. And U.S. foreign policy is right at the heart of this. In Honduras, where many of the people coming to the U.S. southern border come from, a country I have visited three times in this century, I'm not surprised people are leaving. 12-year-old girls are being pressed into prostitution by criminal gangs. Young boys are being forced into joining these gangs and committing crimes. Tegucigalpa, the capital, is the most dangerous city in the Western Hemisphere. And so, of course, there are people who are going to either send their children or take their children in an effort to get asylum. And under American law, they have an absolute right to appear at a proper border station and seek asylum. The problem is, as Robert Petillo pointed out, since Ronald Reagan's version of an amnesty, there has been nothing serious done by Congress. And Donald Trump, who began his campaign for president with a racist tirade against Mexicans, calling them murderers and rapists, used Title 42 in an effort to stop any immigration. It had nothing to do with the law. It had to do with his racist policies. So now you have pent-up demand of people who want to come. And that is creating a real and serious problem, one that could be addressed by better U.S. government policies, both at the border and in foreign policy.
So let's play out the scenario here on the humanitarian side, which needs to be addressed, Robert Petillo. And I'm wondering what you think about it when you have these people who are fleeing. We're going to get to some of the reasons why they may be fleeing their homeland, but they're fleeing where they're coming from, making that dangerous journey, which is dangerous within itself, making that journey, then getting to the border area, perhaps. And then over there, they want to obviously get into, in this case, the U.S. But then they're facing a whole raft of other dangers, where when you take a look at some of the records of what has happened to them, shocking instances of sexual and physical abuse is what I'm reading. You have instances of rape, in some cases murder, that have happened. And in the case of sexual and physical abuse, I'm reading the U.S. border and federal officers have been involved in that. Is there no monitoring of this to happen when they get there, that we're seeing these instances?
I think me and David, we're going to agree that there's little to no monitoring. And part of the issue is that when you create this illicit system, as we have currently, instead of being able to simply follow the international law, present yourself and enter the country under asylum, because most of you people are seeking asylum because of U.S. government policy. Let's not forget that. Because of the war on drugs, because of the banana republic wars that the U.S. launched, because of our propensity for replacing democratically elected leadership with U.S. puppet governments. That's why these people are fleeing those countries. But because we do not have a proper system in place, that creates coyotes who are human smugglers who are able to take these people from their homes. They sell all of their property and belongings to give their children a chance for a better life and often do not make it there. If the Americans have not reformed this system, they have no moral authority to stand up and look at China or any other nation and say that they need to reform their human rights laws. All they've done is push it across the border so they don't have to look at it and see the results to what their policies have been.
All right. Our guest there, David K. Johnson, talked about some of the reasons perhaps that the U.S. May be at fault here, if you agree with them. And if you can give us some examples of some of the countries that perhaps due to U.S. foreign policy or otherwise has impacted the lives, and I'm guessing it's mostly economically driven that they feel that they have to leave the country unless it's for safety and security concerns.
Well, what's happened in Honduras, which is where many of the people at the border are coming from, has been the long-term support of governments that have been unsuccessful in dealing with crime, have been quite corrupted by the drug traffic. But, you know, the U.S. is a place people want to come to, and we are indeed mishandling this at the border. But imagine if something happens in Pakistan, Afghanistan, or Azerbaijan, and floods of people want to get into Iran. Is there any reason to believe that your country would do better at this than we're doing? I mean, these are problems that we see pop up around the world. The Australians are having problems with this, is an excellent example. And part of their solution has been to take people and put them on the islands off the Northern Territories. So, but much as the U.S. is not handling this well, I think we need to see it in a global context.
This global context is very important because here, as our guest there said, Robert Badillo, Iran has been on the receiving end of many Afghans, especially after the shoddy, to say the least, U.S. withdrawal of the occupation of that country, where we really had an uptick in the volume of Afghan refugees, asylum seekers, whatever name you would like to put on it, that came and flowed into Iran. And we did our best, and we still continue to do that. So we know exactly how that feels. But when it comes to this issue, to put it in the world context, where in the what parts of the world is there this flow or problem where there's not? It's not a result of a foreign policy of another country. I mentioned the U.S. because, not to just pinpoint the U.S., because the U.S. is involved in so many different excursions, if you want to call it, around the world, whether it's through itself, covertly, indirectly, or with its allies. That has resulted in that. Maybe you can expand a little bit more for us, whatever examples that comes to your mind. Robert Padilla.
Yeah, I think a perfect example would be countries that are affected by narco-terrorism. These drug cartels are primarily being financed by the American drug habit. 50% of the cocaine in the world is consumed in the United States of America, the good old U.S. of A. And this gives substantial power to the drug cartels, the FARC and other groups that are able to overthrow governments, that are able to bring down the ruling classes and replace them with simply narco government officials who have to buy in for protection. You look at a nation like Venezuela, which was a prosperous nation 20 years ago, but after the failed coup attempt by President Trump when he attempted to replace President Maduro with Juan Guaido, we saw massive waves of migrants leaving Venezuela to try to come to the United States. And then when they get there, the very same political instability that was caused by Trump, they are met with Trump's Title 42 border policy. You can go all the way to the 1980s, the U.S. Great Invasion of Grenada, their intervention in Panama. You can go back to the Banana Republic Wars when Chiquita Banana was able to basically overthrow governments in Central America. All of these things are part of the American sphere of hegemonic influence. And because of that, there is a responsibility, even beyond that, which is articulated in international law, to take in these migrants. Not to mention, these individuals are a net positive to the U.S. economy. Nobody's walking 1,000 miles through the
Good
desert
point.
To come get on social services.
That's a great point, which I want to ask you, David K. Johnson. Whether it's the U.S., of people trying to get into the U.S., or whether it's Europe, much of the people who actually do make it inside the country are involved in the part of the economy that many people of those countries perhaps are not interested in or cannot fill those positions. So they do serve a purpose. Maybe that's something that you could expand on it for us, if you agree with that.
Almost everyone in the United States came here, or their ancestors came here from somewhere else. Mine came in mostly in the late 1800s. And immigrants who arrive with no skills are denounced by the far right in America. But what the research shows is that they are very hard workers. They push their children to be well educated. And by the second, or at the latest, the third generation, almost without exception, they are prosperous. So absolutely, we would be better off if we had a more open policy about immigration. Canada has done very well with its immigration policies. Now, those policies change the nature of who the population is, the demographics of the population. And the people who are white supremacists, the Trumpers, they don't like that. They only want Western and Northern Europeans being allowed to immigrate to the United States. And the world just doesn't work that way.
Okay, great point. Another great point. So, Robert Padilla, let's expand on that. How much of the U.S. population actually feels that way? We know Trump obviously highlighted that,
whether he wanted or not, or whether that was just a reflection of his personality, of the type of people that the U.S. should be composed of in terms of, let's say, whoever wants to enter. But is there that kind of a discrimination when it comes to the types of people who want asylum in the U.S. who then obviously want to be employed in the workforce?
Yes, yes, there is. I'll give you an example that when Russia invaded Ukraine, they announced that 100,000 Ukrainian migrants would be coming to America to seek asylum from the war there, and there was absolutely no outrage. You did not hear the political right, saying that they are coming to change your way of life, this, that, and the other, because they are completely fine with European migrants coming here to seek asylum. During the Trump administration, they said, well, why can't we get more people from Norway and the Netherlands to come to the United States of America? And this is not a strictly America problem. Giorgia Meloni, the new prime minister in Italy, she does not want African migrants coming to Italy. She says she wants Venezuelan migrants who have lighter skin and who come from a Latin background, who speak a similar language, speaking Spanish versus Italian, and says they can incorporate into the society better there. This has been the policy of the United States of America since the 1800s. Since the Mexican-American War, there was an opportunity for America to annex the entirety of Mexico, but they decided not to do so because they did not want to change the racial composition of America to being a majority Latino nation. And this remains the part of American foreign policy, is the unspoken part, where the reason that this is an issue is that if this was migration coming from Canada to America, it wouldn't be a problem. The fact that it's black and brown people descended from slavery who are coming to this country, that is why this suddenly becomes an issue.
All right. And we know that as our guest from Washington, Robert Padilla, indicated, David K. Johnson, has been a problem that it seems like it's been kicked down the road by different U.S. presidents who have come into power. Why has there not been, first of all, a solution that has been effective? Is there one? And or are we seeing this being used as a basis for political maneuvering when it comes to, for example, wanting to have some popularity amongst the general population, an issue that perhaps is used that way?
Well, except for Donald Trump, American presidents actually have tried to get solutions. The problem is in Congress. We have a deeply divided Congress. There's a joke in Washington where back before Ronald Reagan, Democrats and Republicans would jointly rent a house or an apartment and live together. And today the joke is that Democrat and Republican riding in a taxi together is a major act of bipartisanship. So the core of this is the inability to get enough members of Congress on one side or the other politically to move forward. The solutions to this are multiple. One of them obviously is changes in U.S. foreign policy, not doing things like overthrowing governments as the U.S. did 70 years ago in your country. And installing regimes that American non-elected leaders think would be better for U.S. interests. That's an important one. It's especially true in Central America, where many of the people at the southern border are coming from, not Mexico, but south of Mexico. Secondly, we have to address the drug trafficking. So long as drugs are illegal, we're going to continue to have this problem. Drug prices are falling, which tells you the war on drugs doesn't work. And we need to decide we're going to take our losses in a different way, not by corrupting law enforcement and courts, but by instead, and foreign governments, but by instead accepting that some people are going to be drug abusers and they're going to suffer the consequences. That would reduce the power of these criminal cartels in a number of countries outside the U.S. And then we need to have an adequately staffed and system for allowing asylum seekers to come in to have their claims heard, and if they qualify, to let them into the country, and if they don't, to send them back. But we don't fund this in an adequate way, and again, Congress controls funding. The real core of the problem here is Congress, particularly the far-right racist elements in the U.S. Congress who want to make America white again. And I'm playing a little on Donald Trump's make it great again.
Okay. All right. Taking a look at the U.S. President Joe Biden, Robert Padilla, where does it stand with him in terms of, we know that he wanted to, for example, he wanted to end Title 42 in the spring of 2022, from what we understand, because he felt like, you know, at this point, the pandemic is on the wane, which could now be turning a direction. But putting that aside, is he somebody that you see that can help the situation, enact anything that perhaps can improve the conditions, especially at the border in terms of that aspect of it, but on a larger scale, whether it can do anything to stop the people from making that move in the first place? I think that would require Biden to talk with the leaders of the other country, like maybe Obrador in Mexico, to see what it can be done. And I think he has, but we're not seeing the major improvement that is required, have we?
Well, no, and I think if Biden was going to do something major on immigration, it would have had to be done last year. In January of next year, we're going to get a Republican House of Representatives with a Republican Speaker of the House, and they will have absolutely zero appetite to have comprehensive immigration reform. At the same time, President Biden is now confronted by a 6-3 majority for conservatives on the Supreme Court. For the last several decades, they've been maneuvering to take that institution over, and they have shown that they have no problem being an activist court, overruling the President of the United States, overruling Congress when it comes to our immigration policy. So if he instituted executive action on immigration, it will more than likely be overruled by the court, the same way that we've seen the student loan reform be held up and many other executive actions. So there's very little that President Biden can actually do with regards to immigration in the short term. What they can do is take the current law and the current criteria that we have and try to staff up on federal judges, try to bring in more immigration attorneys, provide more resources from the federal government to handle the current influx, put a real investment into it. The fact that America can spend $850 billion, which is the new defense authorization in the latest budget, $850 billion on national defense, but cannot allocate proper resources to the border to have a humane and just immigration system is beyond comprehension. I think the Biden administration has to use whatever tools are available to ensure that we are streamlining the system as much as possible.
And final question to you, which is a general one, David K. Johnson. Where do we go from here in terms of what's going to happen? I have a feeling that we're going to continue seeing these migrants and asylum seekers not just trying to come into the U.S., but from Mexico, but from other, obviously, countries who will strive to get into the U.S. mainland.
Well, as Robert Perdillo pointed out, nothing will happen in the next 2 years that will be beneficial. There may be some very damaging things that will happen in terms of ginned-up hearings about phony issues, but nothing towards resolving these issues will occur for the next 2 years. At core, the American people have to make a fundamental decision about where they want to go, what direction they want the country to go, and that'll be reflected in who is elected to Congress. And of course, in America, over the last 30 years or so, Republicans have made a really determined effort to create